Good morning, everyone.
Good
morning. We are reading in Book 10, the Book of the Double Twilight. We've come to the last canto, Canto 4, the dream twilight of the ideal. And we just heard Mother reading these few lines. She said, Savitri answered to the Almighty Shade. We are in the middle of Savitri's answer to death. And this is the last one that she will be giving. We reached page 658, line 616. But I think we should reread the last sentence that we read last week. A truth supreme has forced the world to be. Line 614 on page 658. A truth supreme has forced the world to be. It has wrapped itself in matter as in a shroud of death, a shroud of ignorance. And in her answer to death, Savitri is going to describe the steps by which that truth is gradually emerging out of that original shroud of matter, of death and ignorance. Would you read, Margaret?
A truth supreme has forced the world to be. It has wrapped itself in matter as in a shroud of death, a shroud of ignorance. It compelled the suns to burn through silent space, flame signs of its uncomprehended thought. In a wide brooding, ether's formless muse, it made of knowledge a veiled and struggling light, of being a substance, nascent, dense and dumb, of bliss, the beauty of an incipient world. In finite things, the conscious infinite dwells. In both, it sleeps in matter's helpless trance. It rules the world from its sleeping, senseless void, dreaming it throughout mind and heart and soul to labor crippled, bound on the hard earth. A broken hole, it works through scattered points. Its gleamings are vistas, diamond thoughts. Its shadowy reflex, our ignorance.
Thank you. Page 658. We just started to read at line 614, and we read to line 630. In answer to all the doubts and discouragement that death is spreading, that the voice of death is spreading, Savitri affirms that this whole world exists only in response to the will of a supreme truth. A truth supreme has forced the world to be. And its first step in that process was to hide itself. The truth has hidden itself in matter, as if in a shroud. A shroud is the cloth we cover a dead body with. This shroud represents death, the process of entropy. It's a shroud of ignorance, of unconsciousness. But that truth supreme has compelled the suns to burn through silent space. The physicists tell us that at the beginning of this universe, as far as they have been able to trace it, There were no suns, there were no stars. There was only a kind of dark soup of elementary particles that hadn't even begun to form atoms. But some force, the force of that hidden truth, has compelled the evolution of matter to the point that the stars have come into being, the suns. And in those suns, all the elements, the chemical elements that make up our world and our own bodies have been formed. No? So that has all happened because of the pressure, the hidden pressure of this supreme truth. So the suns are flame signs of the uncomprehended thought of that truth, the conception which was there in the beginning, which nature has not grasped, we have not grasped, but those, the fact that the stars are there, the suns are burning, it is signs burning in this unconscious matter, signs of that thought behind it all. They are there in this muse, this meditative state of a wide, brooding ether. The vastness of space is filled with this ether, this substance which is so subtle that our physicists haven't been able to detect it yet. They don't believe that it exists because they couldn't detect it. They say it's not there. But Sri Aurobindo repeatedly affirms that it is there. But it has changed its own power. It has made of knowledge, the divine power of knowledge, in this world of matter and ignorance, that knowledge has become a veiled and struggling light. The supreme infinite existence has become a substance, this substance, matter, that is nescient. It has no conscious awareness. It's dense, heavy, inert, and dumb. It can't express itself. The bliss of being has become, has expressed itself in the beauty of this inconscient world, the beauty of this universe, and the beauty that nature shows us everywhere. This is happening because in finite things, in all these limited things that make up the universe, the conscious infinite is dwelling, that supreme truth. It seems to be in a sleeping, senseless void, an emptiness. But from within that senseless, sleeping void, it's ruling the world. As if in the forms of dreams, it's throwing out, projecting the powers of mind and heart and soul. But these powers, these divine powers, here in the material world, they have to labor. They have to work hard. And they are crippled. They can't move freely. They are bound. They're restricted by this shroud of matter here on the hard earth. So that infinite, supreme truth is a whole. But here it expresses itself as a broken whole in all the many fragments, all the many, many individual forms that are here. But it's still working. It's working here and there, wherever it finds an opening through these scattered points. shards are bits of broken pottery or glass. Shards of glass can be very bright, glittering if they catch the sunlight, no? It says, whatever we experience as wisdom, wisdom's diamond thoughts are just gleaming shards, little broken pieces of that infinite truth. And our ignorance is a shadowy reflection of that supreme truth. That, sorry, yes, continue, yeah. No, I think this supreme truth is the creative power. Yes. But this is the way that it's expressing itself.
It is there, it creates. It doesn't come in.
So from the very beginning of these forms, all these various forms, it has been in them, dwelling in them. Otherwise they could never come into existence. Yes. Yes, that's the big difference. In the traditional religions that you are thinking of, the Judaic religions, the divine is outside his creation. I'm just thinking about what Patricia has said. And the reply I would like to give is that the very existence of that supreme truth has forced this world to manifest. Patricia.
This morning before coming to the class, I was in the library here reading the latest Sri Aurobindo action, in which there is the parable of seagulls by Nardini. If any of you have read? Well, I think maybe it's based on the famous Jonathan Livingston seagull, but the point is that there is this one seagull among the group who doesn't want to just have an ordinary life and do everything and breed and create and family and all that. So he realizes he has this joy of flight, just flight for its own sake. So he goes as far and far and far as he can. But then he gets an insight somehow that there is something even more than that. And he gets an intuition that, I'm trying to remember if someone teaches him this or what. But the idea was that he develops the capacity to have a different kind of body. He realizes that it's made of thought. And when I was amazed when we sat down and read this, because this seems to be a description of the same thing. Because the Shobhanaka, I think was the name of this special seagull, and he, once he's on one of these wonderful flights, and another bird comes in front, and to avoid hitting that bird, he swerves and hits the cliff. And so they think he's going to be finished, but he has a different body and he just is resilient and just comes away unharmed. So I thought it's like a preview of the supermental body, and I was trying to understand what he means. I would have to look at the article again to see the exact description. Something about a chain of thoughts. So So if I may say further, it has to do, I mean, I saw something in the film last night. There's a recent film called Sultans by Salman Khan. It's a fictional story, but he's a wrestler. And he's in the ring, and he's almost defeated. But he kept telling himself, my only enemy is myself. And so he just got that inner thought and that inner will, and he remembered the girl he loved, and then he got up. I mean, you know, it's fictional, but the point is that when it says about the shards or wisdom's diamond thoughts, in other words, if we could restructure our mind, even to the level of the subconscious, we wouldn't feel defeated and could feel almighty all the time. Then that new body would come. I'm trying to get my head around that. But isn't it what it is that this body, is, as we see it, is an illusion. This weakness, all the wrinkles, and everything. There is something, this supreme truth is inside, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there's a very nice chapter in The Life Divine which you might like to read about the ascending series of substance.
Oh, yes.
And there, of course, we are in this state now where we've begun to be conscious. We have a kind of thought body, and there's a thought atmosphere of the world. And our matter, the matter of our bodies, is not the same as the matter of metals or suns. No, it has developed because it is living matter. The life force has entered into it. And yes, there's a subtler state which is proper to the mind levels. And beyond that, there are other levels.
Is that a causal body?
The tradition speaks about a series of five bodies, no? The gross material, the subtle material, the life body, the mind body, and then it speaks about the causal body, which is perhaps the body of bliss, the body of delight. But perhaps these correspond also to the five elements. Perhaps that's why there are five bodies. But in that chapter, Sri Aurobindo is speaking about different levels of consciousness, and that for each level of consciousness, there is a substance, and there can be bodies. There are beings who are made of that substance. And in our conscious development, we too can develop these bodies, and he says, we can gradually impose the law of those subtler bodies on this material body. This is the way that this material body will get transformed.
Maybe some people to some extent have already done this. I
mean, definitely.
They were showing the wrestlers, okay? Mm. I think they were from actual wrestlers from Haryana. Mm. And I thought if I were thrown over by someone on my back like that repeatedly, I mean, I'd have my broken back, okay, yeah. Probably. Yeah. And yet they repeatedly can do this. So they've already achieved something, huh?
Yes.
They don't feel pain in the ordinary
I think
way.
Most people who excel in physical achievements, they have some contact with their subtle physical body. Mm-hmm. And there's the story about the famous Russian dancer, Nijinsky, who could make the most amazing leaps. And apparently he has described it, that he could be outside his physical body and he could make it leap. So something like that. It's similar perhaps to the seagull story. Anyway, let's read on. Now, actually, in the next pages, Savitri is going to explain some of these different levels of consciousness. Would you read?
It starts. It starts from the huge mass in countless jets. It fashions a being out of brain and nerve, a sentient creature from its pleasures and pains. A pack of feelings obscure, a dot of sense, survives a while answering the shocks of life. Then, crushed or its force bent, leaves the dead form, leaves the huge universe in which it lived, an insignificant, unconsidered guest. But the soul grows concealed within its house. It gives the body its strength and magnificence. It follows aims in an ignorant, aimless world. It lends significance to Earth's meaningless life.
Thank you. Here the word starts in line 631. It doesn't mean begin, it means emerges. So this is the inner side of evolution. This conscious infinite, this supreme truth, which has shrouded itself in matter, begins to emerge from this silent mass of matter in countless tiny little jets, like little fountains.
What is he referring to? Countless jets?
He's beginning, showing how in evolution the beginnings of living beings emerge. So in life there's a kind of consciousness. It's not a mental consciousness, but there's an awareness. No? So out of that mute mass of what we call insentient matter, these little jets of consciousness, they're coming out because they were there inside, no? The conscious infinite. The truth was there inside matter, within matter. It can emerge here and there in many, many little jets of awareness. And it shapes these into a being, an individual being, a being that has brain, nerve, a sentient creature. And the formation of this sentient creature comes about by the alternations of pleasure and pain. Its awareness gets shaped by that. So those first little beings, those first most primitive life beings, he describes as just a package of obscure feelings, a dot of sense impression. This survives for a time, responding to the shocks that the surrounding universe gives it, these shocks of life. And then it dies. Whatever little strength it has, it's crushed. That little center of consciousness leaves its dead form of physical matter. It leaves this huge physical universe in which it lived, in which it was, this little consciousness was an insignificant guest, unconsidered. Nobody was impressed by it at all. But that's the beginning of the soul, the hidden soul, concealed within its house, within its successive houses. The soul grows, and it's the soul that gives to the form its strength and its magnificence. That conscious soul, the conscious being within, follows aims in this ignorant, aimless world. And the fact that it is there lends significance to Earth's meaningless life.
Maybe it's referring to the birth of a person or an animal or plant or whatever. But jets, like it's, I'm trying to correlate with the science, and in science nothing has come out with it. Like, life getting consciousness out of is thin jets. So I'm wondering whether he's referring to one life.
With the word jets, I think he means like a small fountain.
Yeah, that I know word meaning, but the sense of it.
You can't. Yeah. Well, why does a spring jet out of the earth? Because the water was underneath and there's a pressure and out it comes. Mm-hmm. So in the same way, this conscious truth was within, and where it can, it forces itself out and then gathers around it these sense impressions. This becomes the beginning of a conscious being. It's an image which he uses in several places. He describes this whole process in great detail in Book 2, Canto 4. This slow emergence of life from the most primitive forms to something that looks human. Here, she's just giving us a summary. So the next step in this summary, you would read, Chico? A demigod animal.
A demigod animal came thinking man. He wallows in one, yet heavenward soars in thought. He plays and ponders, laughs and weeps and dreams, satisfies his little longings like the beast. He pours upon life's book with student eyes. Out of this tangle of intellect and sense, out of the narrow scope of finite thought, at last he wakes into spiritual mind. A high liberty begins and luminous room. He glimpses eternity, catches infinite. He meets the God in great and sudden hours. He feels the universe as he larger self. Makes space and time his opportunity to join the heights and depth of being in the life. In the heart's cave speaks secretly his God.
Thank you. So here we are, thinking men, demigod animals. Demigod is a half-divine being. Sorry?
Water possible. You have water possible. Quarter. Yeah. Quarter, quarter, not half.
Oh, quarter.
Yeah. Sorry.
Well, he says half,
no?
So sometimes we, human beings, we wallow in the mud like pigs or hippopotamuses. But we do have the capacity. Sometimes we soar far upwards in our thought. And human beings have not been able to completely get rid of the idea of a divine life as a possibility. So here we are. We play, we ponder, we think, try to think deeply about things. We laugh and weep and dream. We satisfy our little longings just like animals. But we also try to understand the living world around us. We look at it carefully with student eyes. We are studying, we want to understand. Know more about this universe we live in. And it is possible for human beings. Many human beings have done it. They have woken up out of this tangle, this confused interweaving of intellect and sense impressions, emotions and feelings, and woken up out of this limited thought that is our usual range it is possible to wake up into a higher level of mind, spiritual mind. And if we do that, a high liberty begins. We begin to be free. And we begin to feel that we live in a luminous space, that we are not limited and confined. The spiritualized human being can glimpse eternity, get a touch, a contact of infinity. He can meet the universal powers, have unexpected contacts with them. He can expand his individual sense of self beyond this body and feel that the whole universe is his body. And then he sees what we experience as limitations, space and time, they become opportunities. His opportunity to join the heights and the depths of being in light, in a conscious, luminous connection. And in the depths of his heart, the secret heart cave, he can speak with God, have a personal relationship with the divine.
This is a description of the future man. Mother was talking about the future man.
No, not yet. That's going to come. This is about our present human possibility. The spiritualized man is a realized possibility in evolution. It has already been established. That's the highest level which has been established. And in the Life Divine we've been reading recently, above this there are four more levels linking the spiritualized being with the supramental. Sri Aurobindo's described each of these stages in detail. And that's what Savitri is going to do also. She'll describe each of them.
And the rishis and the old seers have done it.
This, yes, they have done it. This is already established. Yes. Yes.
I read this as a kind of biography of the spiritual man.
Yes.
And one of the means to come there, if I understand it well, is to let the thought go. Let the thought go. That's what I think to me, the finite thought, let it go, and then spiritual man can come. In line 644, the description of the thinking man, Sri Aurobindo says, or Savitri says, he wallows in mud, yet heavenward soars in thought.
Yeah, that's what we are doing now. We are in our thoughts, we are reaching for the higher levels of consciousness. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a very important factor in evolution, is human choice and human aspiration. That's the way that new evolutionary possibilities come closer. It's not yet realized, but it's a great help. Yes, it is revealing itself in all of us, in all the forms of earth, giving expression to itself as the beauty of nature, as aspiration, will for a better world, through all the explorations of science. You know, these are all different ways in which that truth is pushing for a greater fulfillment in matter.
Can I just explain the line 659? Try
fragments of Truth Supreme Being?
I think this is where we're going next. That's what we're going to read next. Yeah. Patricia will read it.
Yeah. These are touches and high moments. Fragments of Truth Supreme have lit his soul. Reflections of the sun in Vajra's still. A few have dared the last supreme ascent and break through borders of blinding light above. And feel a breath around of mightier air. Receive a vaster being's messages and bathe in its immense intuitive ray. On summit mind are radiant altitudes exposed to the luster of infinity. Outskirts and dependencies of the house of truth, upraised estates of mind and measures. There man can visit, but there he cannot live.
Thank you.
Before, because we passed, and it was something that I wanted to say, that for me the line that is very important is 657. Because when Sri Aurobindo speaks about after a look for a lot of things, we have the key, and the key is in our heart. For me, it's one of the main things in Sri Aurobindo that I was touching, that we are really there. If we go there, everything is there.
Thank you. So if we say that what we read before describes the spiritualized human being, or the human being reaching towards spirituality, speaking in the heart secretly with God. Savitri says next that these are just touches, indications, special moments, high moments lived. Fragments of the truth have lit up the soul of that individual, or like Ton was saying, when the mind is silenced, there's a reflection on the still waters of the mind of the sun, the high sun of higher consciousness. And a few beings have gone even further, and I think this refers to the rishis. A few have dared the last supreme ascent, and they've broken through this golden lid above the head, these borders of blinding light, and they have experienced a breath of mightier air. And they've received messages from a vaster being, and they've bathed in this immense intuitive ray of sunlight. The rishis spoke about a world above of the truth, the right, the vast. They had seen that. They knew that it's there. So on the highest levels of mind, there are these shining altitudes which are exposed. They are not cut off from the luster of infinity. In the Life Divine, he describes them as Gnostic levels. That is, they are in the knowledge, the light of the true knowledge, rather than the ignorance. These are outskirts, surroundings, dependencies, subject states of the house of truth. Upraised estates of mind, measureless. He's still using the word mind. These belong to mind. But these are levels that haven't yet been reached and established in our evolution. We can reach there in exceptional moments of consciousness, but it's not yet a state that we can live in permanently. Yes?
Can I please ask, regarding that line, a few have dared? Why is it that it's only a few? The light
light and the truth is so appealing and so beautiful.
Yes.
Are we too busy wallowing in the mud, sowing seeds, living in bare existence? Or is it because the inequalities of life don't give enough people the chance to be still and understand the beauty? If they had the luxury of time and lifestyle to contemplate more, would it be an instinctual urge of all beings to seek the light or not? Is it still?
Well, I think we all seek the light according to our own individual level of development. And in one of his aphorisms, Sri Aurobindo has said, if man could only catch a glimpse for a moment of what is waiting for us in the next reaches that our evolution hasn't yet achieved, we would leave everything and just go for it, no? And what he is trying to do always in all his writings is to give us that glimpse. Mm-hmm. And then we ask, as you ask, we say, well, why aren't we doing that? Why haven't we left everything to go for that? No? But there's some other kind of law also, which means that the whole has to move forward. And for that, there has to be a continuous chain. And so it can't be that, well, it does happen that a few individuals go beyond the mass. But for the mass to move, the thing has to become much more general. And that's why there's this movement of the two triangles, no? There's the ascending triangle with just one and a few at the top, but it's moving higher, it's becoming more and more all the time. And at the same time, the higher powers are coming down more and more and more into the mass, so that what is now at the base of the triangle will eventually reach the same state as what is at the peak. Mm.
But not the 100 monkeys yet.
Sorry?
We are not the 100 monkeys yet. It's not the critical mass.
Perhaps the critical mass has not yet been reached.
Yes. Yeah, it'll take ages. It's not coming soon.
It will not come so soon. That's again something we are learning now in our study of the life divine. That, beyond the highest that's yet been established in evolution, there are these four more levels for which there is as yet no center in man. We have the chakras corresponding to our established levels of consciousness, but there are three or four more that have not yet been developed. And this means lifting up the whole each time. And he also says that the only power which has the capacity to do that total transformation is the final power. So there will always be some trailing behind until the final fulfillment comes. And then it will be all embracing.
Well, since 56, the final power is acting in
it's,
the world.
It's acting in
so
the world.
So it wants to confirm himself, consciousness force, and by contamination, all will be done.
All will be done, yes. No, certainly there will be a huge acceleration.
But few dare to take the choice to follow that path, believe everything. That's why
Yes.
But they have to do their own homework. I mean, everybody has to do his own homework.
Yes.
To overcome his deficiencies, his shortcomings, his physical nature. Like a beast. We are part beast, so we have to get over our beastliness all the time. Sometimes
We have to, everybody has
the
to do.
The difference between 56 and before, it was hanging above, in theory, a few glimpses, a few there to go to reach the top.
Yeah.
Once it's down, it works on its own force. Because everyone, every force wants to establish itself, no?
Yeah.
It's a consequence of
There are much many more people like that.
After
the last 75 years, 70 years.
And so, if you want them, you're compelled to undergo the transformation. It creates its own world.
If you work with kids, in 10 years, it's absolutely another thing to talk with the small kids, no? The consciousness, I don't know how.
Would you like to come and take the chair here? Yes.
670.
Yes.
There man can visit, but there he cannot live. May you reason for us to add the verse not yet.
Yes.
That's what three of the law means.
Yes.
Yet. Is it then still man?
You mean when we... Yes, I think it's still man. Yes.
Yes, still man.
Yes. So now he's going to describe the next highest level. Tuan, sorry. A cosmic thought.
670.
The cosmic thought spreads out its vestiges. Its smallest parts are here philosophies, challenging with their detailed immensity, each figuring an omniscient scheme of things. But higher still can climb the ascending line. There are vasts of visions and eternal signs, oceans of an immortal luminousness, flame hills assaulting heaven with their peaks. There dwelling all becomes a blaze of sight. A burning head of vision leads the mind. Thought trails behind it its long comet tail. The heart glows an illuminate and sealed, and sense is kindled into identity.
Thank you. So what Tuan read describes actually two levels. First, the higher mind, these radiant altitudes, where this cosmic thought spreads out its vastitudes. Its smallest parts are here, philosophies challenging with their detailed immensity. This is still a realm of thought, and it may express itself in vast philosophies, yes. And above that, there's a level of illumined mind where the predominant power is no longer thought, but vision. It's full of immortal luminousness. There dwelling all becomes a blaze of sight. So the mind is led by this burning head of vision, which is like a comet trailing its lovely long tail behind it. The heart glows and sense is kindled into identity. Again, when we were reading about these levels in The Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo says they have a transformative effect on the whole being. Each of these ascents.
So, Baba,
yes.
Did he explain about the illumined mind?
Yes. First, higher mind, then illumined mind, and next comes intuition. Mila.
A highest flight climbs to the deepest view. In a wide opening of its native sky, intuition's lightnings range in a bright path, hunting all hidden truths out of the layers. Its fiery edge of seeing absolute cleaves into locked, unknown retreats of self, rummages the sky recesses of the brain, lights up the occult chambers of the heart. It's a spare point ictus of discovery, pressed on the cover of name, the screen of form, strips bare the secret soul. Thought there has revelations, sun bright eyes, the world a mighty and the truth's inmost cabin of privacy, and tears away the veil from God and life.
Thank you. But it's a mysterious beauty, isn't it? Has anybody got anything they would like to ask or share about this passage?
You say that before the mind and after the intuitive mind, yeah?
No. Higher mind,
yeah.
Illumined mind,
yeah.
Intuition, he calls
intuition,
it, the plane
exactly.
Of intuition.
And there is the revelation, no? In intuition. No?
In the way he describes it in The Life Divine, and here,
yeah.
This intuition on its native plane is not just isolated flashes of lightning. The lightnings range in a bright pack. So it is revelation. Yes.
I love the image of intuition just hunting in every corner.
Yes. This very vivid word, rummaging. No? Yeah. The sky recesses of the brain. The mind we can think of as somehow our sky, no? But perhaps there are hidden nooks and corners of it, no? That the intuition can reach and light up and reveal.
What is ictus?
Ictus. It's a word Sri Aurobindo seems to like. He uses it several times. Literally, it is just a point, a sign that's shaped like an acute triangle, which you place on a syllable to indicate that this syllable has to be stressed. So he uses it in a double sense. Of pointing, of indicating, and indicating that this is important. And here he says that stress of intuition on a particular object or thing lights up its hidden truth.
Does it mean the hitting point of an arrow or a spear?
No, but it has a shape like that, like an arrowhead.
It's very fine.
So here he says, like a spear point. Yeah? The intuition presses on something, on the cover of a name, screen of form, and it reveals what they are hiding. Strips bare the secret soul of all that is.
I have the sense that maybe it's sort of more transforming of the lower parts of the nature.
That's what the ictus does.
Yeah, it seems like it's kind of delving into the body, into the life, into the heart, more and opening.
And revealing the truth that's hidden there, yes. So thought there has the sun-bright eyes of revelation. And there the word that comes from that plane of intuition, has a mighty and inspiring voice. It enters into the inmost hidden place, private place, and tears away the veil from God and life. It reveals the full truth that is there.
So you talk about these levels, and in my mind, I am separating.
Yes.
In other words, you can't experience what they say here in the lower level until you get to the upper level. But that doesn't seem...
No, these are...
experience, it doesn't seem true.
I mean, I don't know about any of this from experience. I'm only remembering what we have been reading in The Life Divine, where he spends several paragraphs on each of these levels. No. But overall, he says, A, that all the four levels are levels of knowledge, of gnosis. And that because they are levels of gnosis, they are transformative of the whole being. So they're not just mental states of consciousness. This is states of consciousness that embrace the whole being who assimilates
and
them.
He also says they are merging, all the planes are merging, there's not
of course the
bifurcation or the division.
But they have these distinct characteristics. The higher mind is still a mind of thought, and the illumined mind is primarily a mind of vision, you know? And the intuitive level, it has this characteristic of commanding revelation, that it reveals the truth wherever the concentration is poised. So they have different characteristics, and he says they are in fact distinct planes of existence in the way that life and mind are distinct. No, they have distinct characteristics.
I just thought it's spear point this of discovery. Who hasn't experienced this spear point?
Yes, yes, and then you call that intuition, don't you?
Now, when someone gets a stroke, it's called intuition. It's just for fun.
I think when also the intuition is consciousness false, it's not only that it says other eyes, like that it comes as consciousness false, and then in the false is a meaning in it.
You are used to intuition.
Yes.
So, but this is we could say a reflection in the human mind of this power, this higher power, which has its own plane.
But referring to your point, it's primarily that, but there are other elements of the lower beings also.
Sorry.
I mean, the intuitive mind will also have a lower part, little part of lower mind, and still lower mind. I mean, it's a triangle, but
yes,
it's not
course.
Purely the only.
There's always transitional states.
Yeah. But is it possible to, although we are in the state of that spiritual mind, to have, in some circumstances, access to this level?
He says we can visit them. Definitely we get reflections of them here in our mentality. No, that's why we have words for them. Otherwise, how could we express them? And we can visit there, perhaps, and powers from there can visit us. But they are not yet established as permanent states of consciousness on Earth. So the next one is overmind. Audrey, would you read?
Then stretches the boundless, finite, vast expanse, the cosmic empire of the overmind. Time's buffer, state bordering eternity, too vast for the experience of man's soul. All here gathers the powers that fill the cosmos, take in its house of infinite possibility. Each god from there builds his own nature's world. Ideas are phalanx like a group of suns. Each marshaling his company of rays. Thought crowds in masses seized by one regard. All time is one body, space a single look. There is the Godhead's universal gaze, and there the boundaries of immortal mind. The line that parts and joins the hemispheres closes in on the labor of the gods, fencing eternity from the toil of time.
Thank you. So this is a very illuminating description of overmind, which is a term that we hear somehow in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, in his vocabulary. And I think that he has said that up to the time when he was writing The Life Divine, the earth manifestation had been ruled by overmind, and his aim was to go beyond that, to supermind. So the cosmic empire of the overmind, that is the world of the gods, time's buffer state, bordering eternity, a buffer state. Nowadays, perhaps we don't have them, but it used to be that the British and the Russians didn't want to have a common border, so they kept Afghanistan as a buffer state. You know, they didn't want to have to confront each other.
Shock absorber.
Yes, a kind of shock absorber, exactly. Yeah, a buffer. Trains have buffers on them, no? Yeah. So that state is too vast for the experience of man's soul. All here, all possibilities are gathered beneath one golden sky. And the powers that build the cosmos, these are the gods, take their stations, their positions in its house of infinite possibility. And from there, each god, each cosmic power, builds his own world, the world that corresponds to his own nature. So in that plane, ideas, original concepts, creative concepts, are phalanxed, brought together into a powerful group, like a group of suns. And each of those suns in the group is in charge of his, in command of his own rays. There, the power of thought crowds in masses, but those masses can be seized and grasped in one look. All time is one body, space a single look.
Space with big capital letter, for me, is not different with time. And here is like it's too different.
For us in experience,
yeah.
You and I are occupying different spaces, no?
Yeah.
All of us, each of us has our own special space. And our universe is spread out for us in space. It's not one space. Similarly, in our experience, everything is spread out in time, one moment after another, one thing happens, no? So, but he is saying that there is a vision high up on the cosmic level where all time can be seen at once and all space can be experienced at once.
I would like to go back one more, little back.
Yes.
The cosmic empire of the overmind.
Yes.
Overmind, illumined mind, infinite mind, all these are levels of consciousness.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
But here he puts a time's buffer state of boarding action.
Sorry?
Time's buffer state, it says.
Yes. So overmind is still in the manifestation, we can say. It's subject to time and space. But from there, and it's a buffer state, it's between the manifestation of time and space and the transcendent, eternal, infinite world. It's somehow in between.
Okay. Beyond overmind, there is no time and space that you mean to say.
Let us see what Savitri says next. But from this sentence, yes. You can't imagine something that's too vast for your soul to experience.
No, I don't understand the meaning.
Why he says it.
Actually, the meaning of the sentence, yeah? Because
oh.
it's different It depends on how you read.
Yes. Yes. So this is the universal empire of overmind. And that empire is too vast for the individual soul of a human being to experience. Yeah. Yes.
So then when I always had this image of all mind as an equator of an hemisphere.
Yes.
Is it okay to have that kind of image?
Here he said, if you read carefully, here it says, the line that parts and joins the hemisphere is above overmind. There, with the overmind, that line closes in on the labor of the gods. They are in the cosmic lower hemisphere, and beyond is the higher hemisphere.
So it is not the equator, it's below the equator.
Yeah.
The whole mind is below the equator, right? It's the equator.
It's within. It's within.
I think it is in the lower hemisphere.
You know those Russian dolls that you take apart? Small, like that.
I don't think it has to do with the equator.
The line that parts and joins the hemispheres. So that means there's a lower hemisphere and an upper hemisphere. There's a line that separates them and connects them. We can call that the equator, if we're thinking of a sphere.
Yeah, upper part of the whole mind is that boundary. I think that's the equator. Highest part of our mind is the boundary. Equator. And then you have some. That's what.
Before picturing it, I think it is good to remember consciousness is not an object.
It's not?
An object.
Yes, right, right.
Consciousness is not an object. Yeah, we try to make everything.
Yeah, we've tried to make diagrams and yes, yes.
That's for understanding.
If I remember, if Margaret reminds me, next Sunday I would bring again Mother's map of the cosmos. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We could have a look at that again.
Yeah, Ashish Joshi shows it every week.
He shows it every week. Oh, yeah. So if you can see it on Tuesday, then.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 13 planes?
Yeah.
No, I think he's showing something else. Yeah, it's a different map. Yeah. So I think that's the proper place to stop now. Next week we'll read the description of the world of truth consciousness, supermind. Yes. We'll listen to Mother reading some lines from this canto.
On summit mind, all agent attitude, exposed to the luster of infinity, outskirts and dependencies of the house of truth. A cosmic source spreads out its vastitude. Its smallest parts are here, philosophies challenging with their detailed immensity, but higher still can climb the ascending light. There are vasts of vision and eternal suns, oceans of an immortal luminousness, flame hills assaulting heaven with their peaks. In highest flight climbs to deepest view. In a wide opening of its native sky, intuition's lightnings range in a bright beck, hunting all hidden truth out of their lair. Sought there, has revelation's sun bright eye, the word of my deep and inspiring voice. And thus truth in most cabin of privacy. And tears away the veils from God and the light.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.